fact is sick.
Never mind that.
Why, that's me! Look at me! I'm an old man!
I'm Dr. Emmett Brown. I'm standing here on the parking lot at...
Thank God I still got my hair! And what on earth is this thing I'm wearing?
Well, this is a radiation suit.
Radiation suit? Of course. Because of all the fallout from the atomic wars. This is truly amazing. A portable television studio. No wonder your president has to be an actor. He's got to look good on television.
Whoa, this is it. This is the part coming up, Doc.
No. This sucker's electrical. But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
What did I just say?
The flux capacitor stores... This sucker's electrical. But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
1.21 gigawatts! 1.21 gigawatts! Great Scott! What the hell is a gigawatt? How could I have been so careless? 1.21 gigawatts! Tom, how am I going to generate that kind of power? It can't be done, can it?
Look, all we need is a little plutonium.
Oh, I'm sure that in 1985, plutonium is available in every corner drugstore, but in 1955, it's a little hard to come by. Marty, I'm sorry, but I'm afraid you're stuck here.
Whoa, Doc, stuck here? I can't be stuck here. I got a wife in 1985. I got a girl.
Is she pretty?
Doc, she's beautiful. She's crazy about me. Look at this. Look what you wrote here, Doc. I mean... That says it all. Doc, my only hope.
Marty, I'm sorry, but the only power source capable of generating 1.21 gigawatts of electricity is a bolt of lightning.
What did you say?
A bolt of lightning. Unfortunately, you never know when or where it's ever going to strike.
We do now.
This is it. This is the answer. It says here that a bolt of lightning is going to strike the clock tower precisely 10:04 p.m. next Saturday night. If we could somehow harness this lightning, channel it into the flux capacitor, it just might work. Next Saturday night, we're sending you back to the future.
Are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
The preacher man says it's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a gold dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, my woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. Grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Those women old boys raised on shotguns. We say grace and we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. Came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the Western skies. And we can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and he's taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, 'cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. And we can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
last name is going on in here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Everybody, you're listening to the Mad Science Show with crazy old wild-haired Chaziz, and I got my buddy Steve up in here. How you doing there, brother?
Bonjour.
Bonjour. Anyway, if you jump over there to www.chazizradio.com/superchat.html, there's some links in there for you for some different videos, and most of them are pertaining to high voltage. Imagine that. Old crazy Shazam's be talking about high voltage. But let's see if I'm going to run down a list of it. One of them's a tour of the NASA space station. That's just I threw that in there for a hoot, so you can check it out. Commentary on that was pretty funny. Anyway, the next one down there was a guy taking a motor. He took parts of the windings off and pretty much modified it, and he's melting tungsten with one of the stages of the deal with the flyback on there. It's a pretty impressive little deal that he's got going on. And a mechanical jewel thief from Ludic Science, he did a version of Lid Motors' mechanical jewel thief, where you essentially take a 1.5 volt battery and using a coil of wire and nothing more than a little piece of a transformer that's got on there, another coil of wire, and a neodymium magnet to light up a 1.9 volt LED with the flyback on there. And essentially the LED is, or the magnet and the coil of wire is acting like basically what a speaker does on your stereo system. Every time that wire makes a connection, it makes the coil jump around that little magnet and pulses, and on the flyback you get the LED to light up. And so it's a pretty interesting little video. Whole Ludic Science there. He's he does some pretty good little science projects for you. Might want to check out if you like his stuff. Maybe subscribe to his channel or something. And then the next one down here is a another one, spark gap replacement for Tesla coils. The spark gaps on there, pretty much that one I just got through talking about from Ludic Science, the mechanical oscillator there, or mechanical jewel thief, whatever it was. Yeah, that's what it is. Mechanical jewel thief. You could use that for the same process. Essentially, all this is the spark gap itself and the oscillators or whatever, it's nothing more than a fast-acting switch. Same thing the transistor does for the Slayer exciter. It just turns the power on and off rapidly, and as that field is going up and then collapsing, you get some flyback on there, and it just kind of builds the power up as it goes, and you know, starts pulsing the secondary. The next video down there in line was a 20 to 30 kilovolts from 3 volts. He took a built a little circuit using capacitors and stuff to basically take a 3 volt battery and pulse it to get high voltage through a another version of the jewel thief, jewel ringer, and basically amplifies it pretty impressive. You'll hear by and see the width of the gap of the voltage, the spark gap of the voltage. You can literally hear it. It's pretty amazing coming from a 3 volt battery. So I threw that one up in there for people to check out. And then I think last but not least is my buddy Raymond out there. He's done some videos on high voltage lighting, where he's used some Beckett oil burner igniters to light up some fluorescent bulbs, and takes a lot of measurements with a lumen meter and all that kind of lux meter, and he does a pretty good deal on that. But he's showing you the difference between fluorescent lighting and the newer LED replacement fluorescent lightings, using less wattage on there, but still putting out really good light. So interested to keep up on what all he's working on over there. And so with that said, the key to all of these different deals is the high voltage portion of it. You know, we're still using some really inefficient systems out here to get work done. That, you know, we need to be able to run electric motors and run some lighting and some heating. And for the most part, on the lighting portion of it, like the incandescent elements or light bulbs, those are they need a lot of resistance. They need a lot of current flow going through there, and that current flow backing up inside there creates the resistance, which makes it get really hot and produces the light that you see. Looks like I lost my call there. We'll get him back. Got Steve on here. Anyway, so as soon as that Skype gets back around and stops driving me nuts, I'm going to mute that for just a second. Wait till that call comes back on. But there's an easier way to get that same amount of light out without having to use so much power. And if you can do that with lighting, you'll also be able to do that with heating as well. Steve showed me a link to a video that I also posted up in there that I forgot to tell you about. Where was it? It's on further down. Gotta scroll down and find it. European sulfur plasma light, 1300 watts. So, I have to see if I can get Steve back up on here. Let's try this again. This makes bad for radio. Ring, ring. Hey.
The person you're trying to reach is currently unavailable.
Oh, that's
a drag.
Please
leave a message after the beep.
All right, well, the call dropped there. Brother, I'll catch you when you get back. All right, here we go. I sent a voice message. Must be something in between him and I. Anyway, so basically, throughout the entire time of the electricity that we've been talking about all this time, back in the 1800s and maybe even slightly before all that, we're still using systems today that they were using way back then. We're still using methods of electromagnetics and so on and so forth to turn motors, you know. And I'm thinking that there's a much easier way, and it has to do with plasma. If you ever looked at a plasma ball and you really paid attention to what's going on in that plasma ball, and you could actually put a penny or something on the outside of that plasma ball or a piece of aluminum, and you can feel heat. There's heat generated by that plasma. Inside the little fluorescent bulb starters that they use to start up the fluorescent bulb lightings, turns your ballasts and stuff on and off, and when they get to a certain temperature inside there, that that argon will heat up the little element inside there. There's a thermal switch inside that little fluorescent bulb starter. And as soon as that heat gets hot enough, it will trigger that little switch and turn the lighting on and off. So you'll actually, if you look really closely at all your fluorescent lighting out there, you'll actually see it kind of flickering a little bit because it's being turned on and off real fast. Which, after they get warmed up, they're supposed to be more efficient than your general lighting because you're not running a continuous resistive load such as the tungsten element that they use to preheat the bulbs to begin with. So, with that said, taking that energy away from the generator and moving it into a completely different state of matter, such as plasma, the fourth state of matter, then we know that plasma, it puts off a visible light depending on what gases you're using. Let's try this again. Yeah. You're back. Honest Abe's used ISP service?
Oh, yeah. It's all speed here, baby.
Cool. Anyway, basically, I was talking about plasma and that 1300-watt bulb that you sent me a link to the video there. And they were adding higher voltage to it, and you could see it getting brighter and brighter as they did it. And
The last video that I put into the Shiz's chat was about induction lighting. So there's no filament in it to burn out.
Yeah, that's where I was trying to get to.
All right.
they're already working on it, but if you could get a tungsten element to be able to generate the same amount of heat, you'd get the same amount of light for a whole lot less energy input is what I'm trying to get to, because plasma, there's a lot of heat involved in the center of that plasma. So it wouldn't be that hard to design a light bulb that you would send nothing more than high voltage into, And that high voltage plasma created inside there would actually start to heat up the tungsten, which in turn would release the light that you need. So what do you think about that?
We've still got a filament that can burn out. Now, I looked at this induction light in back in probably around about 2011 when the video was released. There's a crowd in China that have been knocking these out by the tens of thousands since. But they're using high frequency radio waves.
Yeah, see, that's what I'm talking about.
There's not actually any connection inside the tube because it's a sealed vacuum tube. And they've got five tiny little beads of pure mercury which get vaporized and go whipping around this tube. And that's where your light comes from.
I'd like to get a hold of a few bulbs like that. That'd be nice to do some experiments with to see, what different frequency ranges you could actually run that, you know. We know that you can hold a fluorescent light bulb up in next to a Slayer exciter, and you can get that gas energized to light that bulb up just as bright as it would be if it was plugged into a doggone socket. So, you know, with that said, that bulb that you're talking about, I'd be really interested in seeing at what different ranges that thing could actually light up.
Well, just don't place yours as radio to it, because that might be to be a little bit too much high energy.
Yeah, it might blow up with all that high voltage going on.
Yeah, I don't know if it'll blow up, but I'll certainly, I will recommend wearing sunglasses.
Yeah, there you go. Anyway, and on the heating portion of it, see, most of the heating elements that we use out here in our heaters, require resistive load going on there, you know. It's all that energy backed up inside there that causes it to finally get really hot and then start to glow. And the only reason why the light bulb don't burn up, the tungsten element in the light bulb don't burn up instantaneously from all that heat, is because it's in a sealed vacuum glass. So if you could do what they're doing in that tungsten element light bulb without having to have so much current to it, instead just use high frequency either radio wave or high voltage alone, man, you could drastically reduce your lighting cost there. And not only that, the LED technology that they've got going on out there, it's not a resistive load. It doesn't rely on a lot of current flow going through there. Matter of fact, too much current will literally burn them out almost instantaneously. That's why you got to put a resistor on there to slow that down. But with those materials that's inside there, if you built a plasma globe with that same type of material that only relies on electron flow, you could get a super efficient light bulb. You've seen how bright the LEDs out there are. They got some really nice LED lighting these days. And of course, they're not cheap, but I'm figuring that eventually they'll start going down in price. What do you think?
LED technology, to my knowledge, has been around since the 90s at least, because I was working with experimental LED lights in Holland in the greenhouses. So it's kind of at its commercial day, and it's still being used, but I mean, what seems to be coming out from the horticulture side of things is the induction lighting is providing some pretty good results. Now, when you don't have an element to burn out, and it's really down to the ballast, because they put an electronic ballast sending out radio frequencies to activate it, then that's kind of circuitry. And as long as you look after that ballast, it'll probably last a hell of a lot longer.
That the induction lighting, does that put out a lot of heat or what?
Not as much, I don't think. But I mean, you are vaporizing mercury, which you can do at low energy.
Well, you can definitely tell whenever you touch put your hand near a regular normal incandescent light bulb, there's a lot of waste going on there. I mean, there's a lot of heat generated off of a doggone light bulb. I actually made a little water heater using a light bulb. Kind of took it off the idea from
I'm sure you could.
Yeah, I took a coil of copper tubing and put it inside of a coffee can and mounted it onto a ceramic light bulb, and then had another can on the outside of that, and then I filled the inside of between the two gaps with aluminum shavings just to hold in the heat like an insulator. And so basically circulating water through there, it's just like circulating water through your coffee pot. Those light bulbs, believe it or not, they get really hot.
Most people that are into what I might call Jamaican horticulture in Europe and other parts of the world have such an excess of heat, even from something like a 300 watt or a 600 watt metal halide or sodium bulb, that police helicopters with infrared vision can see exactly where it is. And even when I lived in Holland, you could tell the people that were growing weed in their spare room in winter because there's no snow in their room. Seriously.
I believe it.
But that's kind of forced lighting by forcing huge volumes of energy into a filament to make it glow at exactly the right frequency, so to speak, that you get the light spectrum out of it. So for horticulture, that's one thing, but for everybody else, I mean, they're not really worried about plants growing, so, you know, they don't need so much energy. And the compact fluorescent tubes are supposedly using considerably less.
Well, the whole thing to me is this. All the things that we use, such as if you're going to use incandescent light bulbs, and if you could step back and think of a more efficient way to use those incandescent light bulbs, such as everybody knows basic science that heat rises. And so there's a lot of waste heat coming off of that light bulb itself. Why not design a system such as a floor duct system to where you got your actual lighting is in the flooring itself, and that heat is actually rising off the floor, and then you can take that incandescent light and basically pipe it through fiber optics to anywhere you want it in the house. You see what I'm saying there?
Well, have you ever been on a stage when the full stage lighting is active?
It's warm.
It's definitely warm. So, I mean, are we wasting all of this energy to produce light when there's alternative methods? And there are alternatives.
Yeah, there's plenty of alternatives, and that's what I think that this plasma could actually do. And when I talk about plasma, the fourth state of matter, I'm not talking about the hoodoo voodoo version of it that some folks out there think about when they think about plasma. I'm talking about like when you see a plasma ball or an old mercury arc rectifier and different things like that, where you're energizing that gas at such a rapid rate that it's literally producing visible light. And light is heat and heat is light, vice versa. So if you can see it, it's warm. You see what I'm saying? So taking that energy away from the generator in a fashion where you're not creating a direct link right back to the generator and sending that energy that you're trying to take off the generator right back into the generator, invoking Lenz's law, then you're not going to use near as much power. You see what I mean?
Well, it kind of makes sense. You're basically recirculating the power. Instead of shoving it in, you have a loopback system.
Yeah.
That'd make a lot more sense.
When you got, if you draw a circle, and somewhere on that circle you draw a picture for your generator, and you draw a picture for your light bulb, which is your load, that's exactly what's going on there. As soon as you put the power out of that generator to that light bulb, it goes right back to the generator. Alright, and that's what you don't want to happen, because it's creates that second field that starts to slow that generator down and makes it have to work really hard. You know, they figured out AC current, they could ship AC current out further for a reason, you know. It's not a constant loop, you know what I'm saying? It sends it out and it's a fluctuating field, out and back, out and back. And by turning that switch on and off, which the AC is doing, it's able to go out even further and produce higher voltages at longer ranges. And so if you understand that, then you can understand how you would want your that higher voltage to be able to make its way back to the source, which would be the power station. Now, he figured it out a long time ago. I mean, Tesla showed him how to do it. Turning the switch on and off real fast is essentially what AC current is. And you can get almost the exact same results with pulse DC current by turning the switch off and on real quick.
Well, the enemy of all data communications, particularly sending information, is attenuation. And that's basically where the signal loses its strength. Because what most people don't realise is when you're sending something across the internet is ones and zeros. And it's how rapidly that those ones and zeros can be read at the other end. And the strength of the signal itself, the, you know, limits to how much Cat5 cable and the rest of it that you can actually use. And electricity is the same. If you get attenuation on an electrical power line, you're going to have a power drop off.
Yep. Well, so we need to move forward instead of staying. We're kind of stuck in a rut as far as energy usage, because there's only one way to do it according to everybody out there, you know. And we're sitting here trying to figure out ways to build a device that is going to basically be able to run the inefficient junk we got going on right there.
What, like a smart meter?
Yeah. So I'm thinking, if instead of doing that, why don't we just figure out a way to pull that energy off the device that we've already got going? I mean, no sense in reinventing the wheel. We know that that generator has the capability of producing some really massive high voltage if run right. The faster you spin those RPMs up, the more power you're going to produce. And if you're not trying to pull a load off of it directly, then you'll get the same amount of energy out of that generator without making that generator have to work harder. And that's why I'm talking about the plasma state, because you're taking that energy, you're changing it to a different form of energy. Essentially, you're building a diode or a rectifier where you're pushing the energy one direction. It can't come back to the generator. And as long as it can't make a direct connection back to the generator, you never invoke Lenz's law. So with that said, and then I want to take a quick music break right after this, is that if we can put the right team together long enough to build a device, a middleman kind of device in between any existing generator out there, then you will be able to get that generator to be, at very least, a heck of a lot more efficient than what it is right now. I talked about when Raymond was out here, we had one of them fluorescent bulb starters, and we were running it up to about 450 volts, and you could see that during the plasma state, it wasn't bogging down at all whatsoever. But the moment that heat heated up that tungsten or that thermal switch inside there, it made an instantaneous path back to the generator, and that thing dropped to the ground. And while right before that thing dropped to the ground, it actually lit that incandescent light bulb up brighter than it would have been if it was connected, you know, just direct. You see what I'm saying?
Well, you know what this station is? In the manner of John Hutchinson, build it and they will come. Usually in bad suits with sunglasses.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping that that ain't gonna be the problem there. The last video that I put up, let me see if I clicked on it here. Energy transfer. I show in there where I'm shooting the voltage through essentially a bad fluorescent bulb and lighting up a tungsten element. And so, you know, I know that this can be done. Not only was the tungsten element lighting up, it come almost nearly to the stage where it's going to burn the bulb out, but it also lit the bad bulb up, the bad fluorescent bulb. So I was sending the energy through the gas inside that tube, and that was the closed switch. and you could see that there was a whole lot less torque going on there. Anyway, how about a quick music break?
Sounds good to me, mate.
All right, everybody, stay tuned. You're listening to Mad Science. Peace and love.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Is going on in here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
You hear me? Give my creation life!
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Okay, we're back. Too much coffee and too much cold weather don't mix. Anyway, trying to explain this in a different, maybe more simpler fashion is that most of the electric motors that we got today require magnetic field interactions. And the lighting that we're talking about, the tungsten element incandescent light bulbs that are that take a resistive load from all that energy, you know, backing up inside there and causing it to get hot and stuff like that. What I've been trying to explain to people about the plasma and moving the energy away from it, if you could visualize two magnetic fields when they're interacting with each other, if they're close to each other, will couple and become one field. And that's what's occurring during Lenz's law, is it's coupling and it's becoming one field. It's trying to balance itself out. It's acting as a brake and it starts to slow everything down in the system. So if you can keep from creating that second field and that coupling effect, that back EMF that everybody talks about, the Lenz effect, then you can still take that energy away from that generator that you want without that drawback. And so to take it away, you can take it away in different forms. You can take it away in light, you can take it away in heat, which are one and the same. And then, so now you don't have no direct path back to that generator. You don't have that magnetic coupling. You're taking the energy from the light bulb and you're changing it to something completely different. And so, with that said, if you're taking it away in the form of heat, you can use on the other side, you can use that heat to generate electricity in a different manner and run whatever it is, charge whatever it is you need to charge up. So this lighting system that we're talking about, whether the induction lighting like Steve's talking about, or the plasma lighting, it's not going to take that much energy because it's not reliant on a resistive load. Does that make any sense to you, Steve?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was looking at some of the induction lamps that are available in the USA. And a 7-inch circular induction lamp uses 40 watts and will produce about 5,000 Kelvin.
Can you get those in any standard hardware store?
Not really sure how widespread they are in the US, but they're becoming more popular.
Well, I'd be really interested in seeing some of those bulbs. I'm going to look around and see if I can't come across them, buy some off the internet or something like that to run some tests on. Because in that one video you can see where the guy takes 3 volts. He takes a 3 volt battery just through a circuit and is able to produce a really impressive high voltage arc off of a flyback transformer that's been modified with like a jewel ringer circuit.
Ooh.
And so that's that one video that I'm going to scroll up and see where it's at. Anyway, He did this off a 3-volt battery, man. And basically, yeah, there it is. It's 20 to 30 kV from 3 volts. Now, if you can't come up with 3 volts of electricity, then you got problems. Imagine a 12-volt car battery running pretty much the same system scaled up a bit. You know, you're talking about some serious voltage. And the reason why I keep on harping over high voltage is because, you know, it's faster frequency, it's more pressure, voltage is pressure. When you got that high voltage running into any gas, and even mercury vapors for that matter, you know, the little pool of mercury, it's going to heat up. When that mercury heats up, it's going to vaporize. And after the vaporizing portion of it, now it's going to be in the plasma state. And plasma is going to generate light. So the higher voltage you send up inside there, the brighter that thing's going to get. And so my idea with, as far as a light bulb would go, would be to suspend a tungsten element on some insulators inside the glass, where the insulator, the tungsten element itself, isn't actually part of the circuit. It's just kind of sitting in there. And if it's in the center of that plasma, the hotter that plasma gets, the brighter that tungsten's going to glow. You follow me?
Well, do you know what they're using in the induction lamps in China?
No, what are they using?
Argon gas.
Well, there you go, man. Even argon, you know, at one voltage it'll be like purple, and then at a higher voltage it'll be even brighter purple, and then at some point you're going to bring that thing up to such intensity that it'll be white light.
Well, that's the whole point of an electronic ballast in the horticultural lighting system, is to make sure that the exact amount of energy is put into that bulb to reproduce the light spectrum that you need.
And there you go, man. So,
effectively what they're doing is they're drawing, the system that I used, it was a company called Lumitech supplied them, and I had some great results with that on everything from chilies to tomatoes. I even had pumpkins growing at one point, and that was under T5 fluorescent strips. I wasn't even using a proper horticultural light. That was at 4 foot long T5 fluorescent strip that used, I think, 48 watts. And I could grow pumpkins underneath it. Now, I couldn't have grown them to the stage where they'd actually produce fruit, but certainly to get them germinating and get them started, so they were strong enough to put outside, that was for 48 watts. I mean, that's crazy.
Well, that's pretty impressive. The ballast that are in all the standard fluorescent deals, they're magnetic ballast. They got a primary and a secondary on there, and when that AC is fluctuating inside there, it's pulsing out a high voltage spike. That's how they do it, man. But it takes 120 volts AC over here, maybe 220 where you're at, depending on what system you guys have set up on. But that's a whole lot of wasted energy to get something that you could have got for like 3 volts. You see what I mean?
Well, I mean, the standard electronic ballast in Europe runs on 240 volts, 50-60 hertz. And, I mean, the basics of ballasts, I was just looking it up here. For a lighting device based on electric gas discharge to work, the ionization of gas in the tube is necessary. This phenomenon takes place at a relatively high potential difference and or temperature than the normal operating conditions of the lamp. After the arc is set up, the conditions can be brought down to normal. To achieve this, 3 types of methods are generally employed: preheat, instant start, and rapid start. In preheat, the electrodes of the lamp are heated to a high temperature before the voltage is impressed upon them through a starter. Instant start ballasts were developed to start lamps without delay or flashing and use an initial high voltage in place of raised temperatures. It's all, as you were saying, it all sounds like it's resistive energy, because that's where you're getting your heat from.
Yeah, when you very first turn on your fluorescent lighting, that's when they're the least efficient, because it has that section of time where it has to turn on their little tungsten elements in the end of each of those bulbs. Those are preheaters. Those will heat up the gas inside there to make it faster when the high voltage is applied to it. Then that light will light up. Well, at a high enough voltage, you don't need that preheater, because it'll be an instantaneous deal. If you took those tungsten elements completely out of there and just run nothing but high voltage through there, even at the same volt range that they run at now, which is I think about 2,000 volts that they're running at right now, coming out of that ballast, each one of them. And so that 2,000 volts, It, without that preheater, it will take longer to get that bulb to light up, like, especially during winter time. If you ever notice how your lighting in your fluorescent lighting is a lot slower to come on, that's because it's taking longer to heat up with that tungsten element that's in the back there. That's where your bulb starter comes into play, because it's turning on and off the resistive load to that tungsten element to create the heat that warms that bulb up. And so when that bulb cools back down, it has to be able to kick back on again. That tungsten element will kick on and off depending on the temperature of that bulb. And so if you can send a high enough frequency through that, you don't have to worry about preheating it. Once it's in the plasma state, it'll keep itself warm. You see what I mean?
What's interesting, Chiz, is if you take like a just the standard cell phone or something, and take a video of the difference between a high pressure sodium and a an LVD light, an induction lamp, there's virtually no flicker rate off the induction lamp. But if you look at the either tungsten element or high pressure sodium metal halide bulb, the thing will flicker like mad because you're getting roughly 24 frames a second on most video footage, unless you've got a really good camera. That flickers so many times per second that it's picked up by the device where your eyes don't generally see it.
Yeah. Well, if you noticed inside of, like whenever the bad bulbs, the fluorescent bulbs go bad, you'll see this black crud at the end of it. That's because, that continuously turning on and off, that it's really hot in that area of the bulb. But it's not even necessary. All you got to do is send the right energy through that bulb, and you'll get just as much light without the waste. I mean, essentially, you got somebody standing there turning the light switch off and on real fast. That's it. And the flicker rate comes from whenever that doggone fluorescent bulb starter, it's turning off and on real quick. Every time that element heats up, it turns the AC on and instantaneously puts power to that deal to keep that gas in that bulb at a certain temperature. And if you don't need to keep the bulb at a certain temperature, if you can just send the right frequency through that gas bulb, you're not going to have to waste nowhere near the amount of power that those things will waste. And so pretty much you could take away the portion of the ballast. You wouldn't need ballast anymore. You just have a custom, like the oil burner igniters. You see what I mean?
Well, you don't even necessarily have to have something that goes inside the bulb. I mean, if you've got the right gases in a vacuum tube, then you can just affect that field. And that's what it looks like the induction bulbs are doing. I mean, they've got tiny little mercury pellets in a little side tube on the ring. And once they're vaporized, then they start spinning around that ring. They kick out a lot of energy.
Well, if people's ever seen how some of these induction coils work, if you made a coil of any, like just copper tubing would do it, and you put the right voltage to that deal, whatever you put in the center of that coil is going to get extremely hot. And since mercury is liquid metal, you're going to get it extremely hot. And so, light is heat and heat is light, vice versa.
Well, the thermometer isn't really so much a measure of temperature as it is a measure of energy.
Well, that's pretty much all we're doing anyway, is shipping energy one place to the next from point A to point B. And we're all just looking for a more efficient way to do it. And as far as I'm concerned, it's been there all along. Nobody's took the ball and ran with it. They had the mercury arc rectifier back in the 1800s. The late 1800s, they already had a plasma reactor. So
I mean, basically, our modern world is based on the idea of taking energy, storing it for use, and then trickling it off for your various different requirements. Do you get what I mean by that? I mean, they're taking oil out of the earth and they're burning it to create energy, instead of harnessing what's around us.
Yeah, so imagine how much energy is actually getting wasted in just the process of generating it.
They have to drill a big hole in the ground, and they have to pump it out, stick it in the barrel, ship it around the world to make sure the prices stay the right volume. But yeah, I mean, the whole process and procedure of using, I suppose, carbon-based fuel systems to create energy is a bit ridiculous, because the amount of energy that they use to get it, is it commensurate with the amount of energy that we actually receive?
Yeah, and then once we actually start using the energy that we do receive, we waste the majority of that as well. So from start to finish, from the ground all the way out, the way that they're running it, the fossil fuels system out there is so inefficient that we're wasting more then we'll use it. You know, back whenever they very first started using crude oil, they were only getting the kerosene off of it, and they were dumping the doggone gasoline portion of it out because it was too volatile. They couldn't figure out any way to use it at first.
Didn't surprise me.
Yeah.
But when you look at nuclear power stations using plutonium, uranium, that sort of stuff, I mean, that's spitting out random energy all the time.
Yeah.
So again, they're harnessing the energy and they're trying to store it in whatever infrastructure so it can be delivered to people and used as they require. So instead of having these kind of mass delivery systems of energy, why have we not found a way of harnessing what's local in the ambient environment?
Well, there's a lot of uranium in the dirt. There's a lot of natural radiation in the dirt. And
well, the personal nuclear reactor pushes it.
Well, I'm just saying. I mean, anytime radioactive material is sitting there decaying, it's releasing energy. So there's energy there all along. And if you can capture that energy and basically ship it on down the road and change it into something you need, I mean, what I'm talking about doing with the plasma isn't any different than what they're doing with the nuclear radiation and the nuclear rods that they refine to boil water. That's all they're doing. They're taking these really super hot rods and sticking them down in the water, causes the water to boil and producing steam, which they use to turn turbines. All right.
Somebody laughed at me when I said to them, they're asking me about what is a nuclear power station, and I said, well, it's a glorified kettle.
That's all it is.
It's a pretty expensive one and a pretty dangerous one if anything happens to it. But
well, yeah, you know, if plumbing fails all the time, you know, it gets old, corrodes up or whatever, it gets weak and it fails. And so if your plumbing fails and you got radioactive water going through there, it's blatantly obvious that might not be something you'd want.
Now, an alternative to uranium is thorium. Now, thorium salt reactors were extensively experimented on, and they were found to be pretty safe. Because if there's any case of a meltdown and you lose your energy supply, it goes back into a salt solution.
Well, there you go.
Once you heat thorium salts, they go into a liquid form and give off a lot of heat. But if anything happens to it, then it just stops. The reaction stops. And how much energy do you need to boil water?
Well, the way that they go on about it is boiling it to extremes. There's, once those radioactive rods are refined and as hot as they are, there's no way of controlling how much heat those things are going to release. I mean, they're hot, okay, and so they're going to boil. And now it's up to you to figure out a way that once you get that water to a certain temperature, that you can cool it back down. Thus forth, they got big old cooling systems and condensing systems that will cool that water back down and ship it back around so that it can keep those rods cool. When the water runs out, those rods are going to continue to get hot because they're hot, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and they're going to get to the point where they get so hot that they melt themselves back down into their natural state, and in the process of that creates one heck of a mess. So instead of going through all that, Why don't you just bring the, if you're going to refine them at all, refine them to a fraction of what they are to make them just a little bit more hot than what they would be naturally, and use that energy in a different fashion. I mean, if you had, I would love to see somebody take one of these doggone fluorescent bulbs and set it near a radioactive rod and see if that thing don't glow.
Actually, we could probably find out if we looked into what sort of lighting systems were used in nuclear reactors.
Well, that'd be something good to check out, because, you know, if that doggone thing's releasing energy at the rate that's enough to energize that gas in that fluorescent light bulb, you don't even need to buy a Geiger counter anymore. You just carry around a light bulb. If it starts to glow and there ain't no power source around, you know what I mean?
William Clinton is sure there is. There's plenty of pictures of Tesla holding light bulbs.
Yeah.
I mean, they've been there, done that, and we still pay for them to ship it to our homes.
You could literally build, if that theory pans out, you could literally build a light bulb that you wouldn't even have to power. It would be a self-powering light bulb. It'd just be, as that radioactive material is decaying, and if it's got a half-life of, let's say, 90-some-odd years, you got a light bulb that'll last 90-some-odd years.
You know? I just really wouldn't fancy having my DNA torn apart by the random electrons flying off of that particular material.
Well,
that might be detrimental to your long-term health.
I don't know, man. All I can say is the video nuclear scare scam with Galen Windsor says a different story than the actual version of it. So maybe it is, maybe it ain't. But, you know, only one way to find out.
It was an interesting conversation, too. I mean, what if this stuff is not as deadly as they pretend it is?
Well, if it's not as deadly as they pretend it is, then that means they knew all along that you had a basic material that would give everybody free lighting forever and a day, and there ain't no money in it.
No, certainly not.
Could you imagine a light bulb that you never had to plug in? That you just, all you got is like in the sleeve that whenever you want to turn the light off, you just cover it up?
Well, yeah. I was going to say, without a switch to turn it on and off, though, it might be difficult to sleep.
Well, you know, that's why I say, just put it in a little slide deal where you can just cover it up so you can go to sleep.
It is interesting, though, that they're using radio waves produced by an electronic ballast to power some of those induction lights.
Yeah. Well, if you look at some of them old CB guys out there, they've been boosting up their doggone CB radios to see how many volts they can get to shoot a light bulb. They're literally getting some arcs coming off of the doggone antennas hitting the ground.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive power, man. But, you know, Muddy was talking about a long time ago, taking a little coil of wire and an LED, and he could tell how close his buddy was. Every time his buddy would key up, it would light that dang light bulb up. Huh. You know? So, you know, the wireless energy deal, that's been around forever and a day.
I had a conversation with a ham radio operator in England about 2 years ago. Nice old guy, really knew his stuff. Especially about, you know, battery power storage, all this sort of thing. He had a really nice setup. But I was asking him, why do you buy a license to talk to other people from the government? Why do you buy, like, permission from the government to talk to people all around the world? And he didn't quite get it. And I said, well, you know, you're speaking to somebody in another country, but you need to pay this third party in between so you're not breaking a law to do it.
Yeah.
Where do they come in? I mean, do they give you any help or advice or even a little booklet? Or is it just pay us if you want to talk to someone, because, you know, we don't really like the idea of communications that we don't control.
You know, I was just thinking about something you said a second ago about your DNA getting smashed by the energy being released, and I was thinking, if this, let's say you had a radioactive pellet that was inside the very center of a light bulb filled up with argon. Just like the doggone on the microwave, the Faraday cage that's in the door of your microwave oven, it breaks that signal up before it ever even gets out the front of that microwave. So when it comes out the microwave, it ain't a microwave anymore when it comes out the oven. And so with that said, if the radioactive pellet was in the very center of this gas, and as it was releasing its energy and slam it into the argon molecules, would it then in turn work like a Faraday cage? And so by the time it came out of the bulb in the form of light, it was no longer the dangerous form of radiation. That is, if it is even dangerous to begin with. You see where I'm coming from?
Yeah, I mean, they've lied about so many different things for so many years now. You kind of... you have to, if you have a rational mind, to question it.
Yeah.
I mean, way back in about 2009, I started looking at stuff like the YouTube video, everything that you learn is wrong, everything you've ever known is wrong, that sort of stuff. And when I did start looking at it, I had to start asking questions of, you know, what is the purpose of a lot of what we're put through on a daily basis? Is it because, you know, there are dangerous elements, and there are, I mean, high electricity is dangerous, there's no doubt about that. But why do we need it?
Well, I don't think we do need it. I mean, like, for example, the difference between, doggone it, helium and hydrogen. Does the Hindenburg ring a bell to you?
Well, we spoke about that before, Shaziz.
Yeah.
The reason for the Hindenburg disaster is because the U.S. government refused to let them fill it full of helium.
Well, there you go. See, there was...
So they put hydrogen instead and it went poof.
There was an easier, more efficient, more safer way to do it, and yet that's what they got. They got you just basically made a bomb. Anybody lights a smoke and you got problems. A little short spark and you got problems. So you got this big, huge bubble up in the air. Could be building up a static charge, you know, and that's all it took.
So, yeah, I mean, one of the jokes going around a while back was, what's 300 feet long and goes woof?
The Hindenburg?
Yeah, German airship.
Well, if it would have been helium, you wouldn't have that problem. Worst case scenario, it springs a leak and everybody talks like Mickey Mouse. All right?
Well, I think that was probably part of the problem, because, I mean, in that time... You know, you had some budding world dictators and they didn't fancy sound like Mickey Mouse.
Yeah. Alright, well, how about another quick music break?
Yep, we can do that.
Alright, everybody, listen to Mad Science. Stay tuned. Peace and love.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission... To explore strange new worlds. To seek out new life and new civilizations. To boldly go where no man has gone before.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
There's something happening here. But what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Every time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away, we better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going, we better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going, we better stop. Now, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going, we better stop.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
All right, everybody, we're back. You're listening to Mad Science. We've got Steve on here and old crazy old Shazizz. Essentially, what we're talking about is the way we use our energy today is like super efficient, inefficient, and there are easier methods to do the pretty much the same work. Now, people could step outside the box long enough to, take in consideration that there's other possibilities. You know, when I talk about plasma and heat and light, that's the biggest portion of your energy usage right there is the waste that you get off of the systems that we're using. Now, if you take that energy away in the form of heat, you can boil water with it. All right. So what's to stop somebody instead of refining high radioactive to a really highly radioactive rod to produce the heat, instead of doing that, run that water through a reactor that, like an argon reactor, that is heating up the water that way, because you know you get the voltage high enough in whether it be a stainless steel tubing or copper tubing or whatever, liquid goes through there is going to heat up, and at some point if you get hot enough, it's literally going to flash the steam just like it would if it was going through a regular fired boiled furnace or whatever. So, one generator that is capable of producing extremely high voltages sent in through an argon reactor that is producing not only light but heat in the same process will be heating up whatever liquid you, or gas even for that matter, that you put through that tube. What do you think about that, Steve?
Not much, really, because I haven't got half a clue what you're talking about.
Well, I was talking about the waste heat off a light bulb?
Yeah.
Regular incandescent light bulb, you can hook a pyrometer up to it, and you'll see that those light bulbs, they'll get up to a couple hundred degrees, and quite rapidly for that matter. And so that's a lot of wasted energy.
Well, in fairness, it is. When I was running a 600 watt metal halide lamp in my home, it was so hot in that room that I needed to vent the heat out. So instead of venting it outside, I just passed it through the three rooms upstairs that we used to use. So I was heating the house because it was 3 kilowatt element in my water heater for the radiator system.
Well,
so a 600 watt horticultural lamp is enough to heat. I mean, it wasn't warm, but it certainly wasn't cold. And this is when it's maybe -1, -2 Celsius outside.
Well, you'd be surprised what a few temperature difference would mean in the comfort that you are in your house. You know, you're not going to freeze it. Matter of fact, my older brother one time told me about keeping birthday candles, like little tea light candles or something like that. Keep them inside your car. He said during the wintertime, if you get broke down, he said the heat off of that right there, it's not going to keep you feeling comfy warm, but it will release enough heat that it will keep you from freezing to death. You know?
Well, in fairness, Eskimos in their igloos would have animal fat oil lamps and that would bring it just up enough that the igloo wouldn't melt, but a level where they wouldn't freeze.
Yeah. So
I mean, there's the sense in that.
You can learn a lot from the Eskimos out there, man. I mean, they survived out there in the worst possible conditions out there, house made out of ice.
Well, in fairness, a lot of people have said, oh, you know, the Northern Hemisphere, nobody can live there. And they said, well, what about the Eskimos that have been there for thousands of years? They seem to be doing all right. Well, until you turned up and started telling them that they're going to live somewhere else.
Yeah, until the power company come down here and has said, hey, buy our electricity and our gas.
Yeah.
They were staying warm. I mean, they survived. You know. So, that's pretty much what I'm saying is that, you know, a lot of the basic science that would tell you one thing, you listen to the mainstream science guys that tell you totally opposite, you can't do this, you know, that defies this law of physics or that law of physics, whatever, explain to me why it is that we're wasting so much energy to light up a light bulb that majority of that energy is going out in the form of waste heat. Alright, if that same light bulb was built somehow down into the floor of the house, we already know basic science says heat rises. And so you could have the baseboard of your entire floor lit up and have that heat rising up, and then use fiber optics to pipe that heat up around the areas of the room where you wanted it. I mean,
well, uplighting is kind of, I've seen quite a lot of uplighting systems. But the problem is if you have ground-based lighting systems, you're not going to be able to see what's on your table when you're eating it. So.
Well, that's where the fiber optics kind of stuff comes in play. Like you was talking about where the guys were taking the 2-liter bottles and filling them up with bleach water and putting them through the roof. You know, that light's going to refract through there.
So yeah, but you still need to put them on the roof.
Yeah, so you run pipe at the wall, inside the wall where you can't see it, and then you got a pipe with a clear glass at the other end of it over the top of your head, and pipe the light up.
Well, in fairness, yeah, there's a certain amount of that. If you use industrial mylar, like the horticultural grade mylar, any light that hits it, 95% of it gets reflected back again.
So you
line your walls with mylar, you have ground-based lighting and heating, so you haven't got like a light on the ceiling that's, you know, basically filling up the top inch, 2 inches of your room. I mean, when I worked in the kitchen years and years and years ago, when I first started out as a chef, sometimes we'd have to clean the tiles, you know, but if this was after the ovens had been on and you stood on the chair to get to the highest part of the tiles, nearly 8 foot up, that maybe anywhere from a foot to the top 2 inches was massively different in temperature. I mean, I got a thermometer out one day and it was 42 degrees Celsius. I mean, I'm 5'8", so when you're kind of standing at a lower altitude, so to speak, it was bearable. But if you got up on a chair, I mean, one of the fellas was cleaning up, then he fainted because it was so warm.
Yeah, the majority of the heat stays on your ceiling, so that's why your doggone heater has to work so hard. The heat rises, it's all up there. So if you had your chairs and all your deal with real long legs and steps to get up to them, set up on the ceiling, you'll stay warm.
Actually, talking of mad science, recently I've been baking a lot of cakes. I mean, I'm just trying to find my way in the world where, you know, there's rules and regulations that restrict me from my previous occupations. But I've been working with food colour, believe it or not. How to make natural food dyes. Because I'm not really too impressed with all of the chemical-based ones. I mean, you've got like red, yellow, blue, green, all of these various different colours. But they're all made from concentrated chemicals.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, well, if you can make food dyes, say, I mean, things like red cabbage are quite interesting because when you boil it down to get the juice from it and you stick baking soda into it, it turns blue.
Well,
because it's pH.
blueberries and blackberries, those got color to them.
Yeah, but you don't have it in strong enough concentrations. I mean, beetroots are great for red because the what's the name? It's I forget what it's called. There's a chemical in it called betaines or something like that. I've forgotten now. But I mean, that is really, really good for dyeing stuff. And why couldn't we use these in lighting systems?
I don't see why you couldn't. And speaking of lighting systems, I was thinking about when you were talking about floor-based lightings, heck, a mirrored ceiling, reflecting that light up off the floor from the ceiling. How do you think that'd work?
Well, yeah, I mean, you'd be constantly looking at your own bald spot, but...
Well, either way, if you're getting a plus out of the thing, if you got the lighting on the floor and you're running tungsten element light bulbs, incandescent light bulbs anyway, you might as well take advantage of the waste heat that's going on and use that to supplement your heating system.
Yeah, but then you wouldn't be using as much energy, and, you know, shareholders would be kind of one glass of champagne less at the end of the year.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'd love to get a group together and just build a small house from ground up with all these concepts that we're talking about in there, the most energy efficient home ever designed in the history of time, weatherproof as far as basically built like a thermos, you know, when it's cold inside, it stays cold inside, and when it's hot inside, it stays hot inside. You know, really good insulation throughout the entire deal, using everything from lighting for heating to, you know, solar, wind, everything. Just a perfect home. And I believe it could be done with all these concepts that we've been talking about, you know, here on the Mad Science Show for years now. So, you know, if you want to heat your water, you could actually use the doggone ground-based lighting as well to heat the water, taking some of that heat away in the form of, you know, circulating the water through some tubings or whatever.
Well, what is underfloor heating other than a resistive, energized strip of copper?
Well, there you go. So, basically, you could circulate water through that, and you're not going to lose any heat, because any heat that would come back out of that copper tube is going to be back in the room anyway. So you would get the lighting that you wanted. You'd get the heat, heating your water up. You would heat your room at the same time, on all for the same amount of energy that it would take you to run that doggone single light bulb itself. You know?
Well, in finishes, it's the Romans were... great builders, and they built massive underfloor heating systems for their villas, but they also used the same fires that they used for heating, because they basically had big tunnels effectively underneath all of their villas, and they pumped hot air through it, but they used to heat all the water for it, for the baths as well.
Well, that's efficiency, that's what I like. So with this plasma lighting that I'm talking about, if all you got to do is produce high voltage in order to get the same amount of heat, and you don't have to work as hard because you're not trying to draw as much current watts and amps as far as the standard system does, how inefficient they are, you know, you're taking one generator, producing a really high frequency, high voltage charge, and energizing that gas into the plasma state, and then taking that energy away in the form of heat and light. You know, it's
that's one of the big questions. Are the systems we're currently using and proposed to us as being wonderful actually efficient?
Well, as far as I can see, all the measurement equipment that they use, such as wireless AC testers, if the field is outside of that electric motor, then it's wasting energy, because all you have to do is have those two fields be able to interact with each other, the magnet interacting with the magnetic field of electromagnet, you know, to turn that motor. You're still going to get the same amount of work by tuning it back, you know, you're just not going to draw as much energy to do it. So
it's like one of these macho muscle cars. You know, you've got 1,500 horsepower under the hood, and then you've a 55 mile an hour speed limit.
Yeah.
seems a bit crazy, really. I mean, we're still using 3 kilowatts of energy to boil water. It's called a kettle. I mean, I'm English. We drink tea by the gallon.
If
World War III started tomorrow, 1,000, well, probably nearly 1 million old ladies across England would be saying, "Don't worry, dear, I'll put the kettle on." You know, if you want to put the kettle on, love, you want to make sure it's going to boil in less than 4 minutes, because that's how long you got.
Well, the induction heating seems to be like super fast, so you could actually design your doggone kettle to heat up so rapidly your water almost instantaneously boils. I've seen a few videos out there like that, that as soon as you put that water in, it's going. You know, it's already boiling. You know?
Well, back in the 60s they were doing experiments with induction heating and cooking systems, induction cookers, where you could have an induction hob. You could stick a sheet like a newspaper on top of it, stick your pan on top of that, and fry an egg.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't touch the paper.
It's basically interacting with the water molecules. You know, water is a dipole molecule, and if you can get them to vibrate rapidly, they'll produce friction and heat, and they'll boil. So.
I don't know. I don't think a lot of the system. I don't think a lot of the systems are actually that efficient, and I think they're inefficient, mostly because we'd be free.
Yeah, I've been watching a lot of these videos where people are modifying existing electric motors, and they're getting a lot of anomalies out of these things. A lot of impressive deals that you normally wouldn't think that a motor was capable of. Such as that one video I put in there where he's melting tungsten element off of one of the deals on the rotor there. You know, that's pretty impressive. So, you know, there's a lot more capabilities to some of these already existing, like the motors that coming out of them Fisher and Paykel or Samsung direct drive front loader washing machines and dryers. Those things have some amazing capabilities for power. That guy hooked one up to a 5-horse Briggs & Stratton, and man, he was pulling arcs off of that thing you could have set fire to stuff with.
Well, she says, if we can produce devices that can melt tungsten, that's kind of a pretty dense metal, what's to say that we can't produce sufficient energy to smelt ore?
Well, you could. You know, at the right frequency, anything will burn. You know?
Well, I mean, you probably need quite a lot of it, and you need quite a large truck to dump it off, and then you'd need all the rest of the infrastructure. But what's to say that you don't start producing your own metals? Because, to be perfectly honest, the technology that they had when they built the Titanic wasn't that great, and that's part of the reason why it sank, allegedly anyway. There were defaults, there were faults in the metals that made them crack under cold water.
Yep.
Now, eating an iceberg didn't help much, but, you know, if there weren't so many flaws in the metal itself, then there's a very good chance that they wouldn't have sheared as much.
You had a little bit of common sense instead of trying to rush that thing across something that you know there could be an iceberg in the way. That didn't help the situation out any either, so... You know.
Well, our current energy system seems to me a bit like the Titanic, and there's a lot of people out there that are screaming down the radio, there's an iceberg, and the captain standing there said, "Well, I don't care, full steam ahead."
Yeah.
I mean, would I be so wrong in kind of
because they're talking about power grid failure all the time, you know. You got a bunch of wires strung all over the place. They're talking about electromagnetic pulse coming from the sun, basically shutting everything down. You know, if you know you got that problem, then why don't you design your system to absorb that energy as opposed to having the energy trash you out? You know what I mean?
Absorbing energy is an interesting concept, because are you so much absorbing it or redirecting it?
Well, redirecting it, railroad tracks, that's all the wiring is in a doggone electric motor anyway. It's just guiding that field around, you know, consolidating it. If you stretch that wire straight, in a straight line, and put the same amount of energy to both sides of it, you'd still get the same amount of electromagnetic out of it. It just wouldn't be consolidated into one general area. You'd still have a magnetic field coming off of it, but you coiled it up, bunched it all together, and so all those fields couple with each other and basically makes a really strong field, you know?
Well, from what I get from Tesla, from what I've read of stuff that he's written that's available and all the various other bits and pieces that I've researched, what he was saying is we're surrounded by oodles and oodles of energy. It's just we haven't developed the systems of redirection and harnessing it so we can release it as we need it.
Yeah, I wish I could remember the equation for every meter or every yard that you go up, it's like 100 volts of just energy coming out of the air alone. And the reason why you can't just like plug something in the ground and put a wire up there is because now it's grounded, it actually creates a bubble above the let's say you got a tower, it puts a bubble above the tower, and the opposites attract and positives repel or whatever, you get this space in between there. So whenever these guys take and fly these little drones up there with a little thin wire, then you can actually pull down that energy, and as long as it's not directly grounded to the ground. See, one side of the static motor, I think rimstar.org did one of these here recently, but one side of the static motor is connected to the wire you got floating up in the air, and the other side is connected to the earth ground, but there's no direct couple between the two, so you can actually pull that energy down. So if you made a tower, and the tower wasn't grounded to the earth itself, it was insulated away from the earth with a big thick insulator just to keep that energy, being able to have a path down. Once you connected something like a ground rod to the ground and had a spark gap in between there, then you could get that energy transfer that you want. You see what I'm saying? You wouldn't have to go up hundreds of feet. They go like 300 feet in the air, and they're bringing down a couple thousand volts of electricity. You would only have to go maybe 40, 50 feet in the air and still be able to bring down hundreds of volts, and hundreds of volts is more than enough. You see what I mean?
Well, this is what I was talking about with the inefficiencies. Do we need as much energy as they're throwing at these devices to actually make them work effectively?
Well, I don't think they do. I think that if you was able to turn that thing back, I mean, a small example is over in your area, I think they got it at 50 hertz. Over here, they got it at 60 hertz. All right? You know you can dial it back to at least 50. And I would venture to say that your appliances will last longer than ours. You know, because they're not generating as much heat. You see what I mean?
Well, in industrial servers back in the kind of early noughties, the CPUs and all of the equipment used to run so hot that you had to have really, really effective air conditioning systems to get them to actually run. I mean, I think it was an Alpha 8400 was a proprietary server from I forget who manufactured it now. But basically, they had to shut down one of the lift shafts in the building to provide enough power that they could run the air conditioning. Because if that thing went over about 38 degrees Celsius, it just shut down.
Well, computers ought to be a really good hint that what we're talking about is fully plausible. Because what you just talked about there is those processors are getting so doggone hot. If you ain't got the right heat sinks on there and you ain't got fans blowing across them, they'll burn themselves up. You know? There's a lot of waste heat going on in just a computer alone. I got this one computer down here, the one that Linux is running on. It's in the cabinet down there, and I got to leave the door of the cabinet open while this thing is running because it generates enough heat that it'll get too hot. Shut itself down.
Which is this, the first generation of the i7 series CPUs required about 145 volts of power to get it to, 140 or 160 watts to get it running at full capacity. So if you were playing like a game, I think Crysis was around about that time, the original version, or the first episode of Crysis. If you wanted to run that at 1080p at 60 frames a second, you know, you would be pumping huge amounts of energy into that CPU, which caused huge amounts of heat. But now, once you've got to a couple of generations later, they're using nearly one third less or more less of energy to do incredibly faster speeds.
Yeah. Well, I think that with just a little bit of common sense and some step back and some modifying some of the existing stuff that we've got already today, that we could make our systems a heck of a lot more efficient than what they are. I mean, there were guys that were taking capacitors and using the capacitors to carry the majority of the load and actually causing the electric motors to use less amp draw. They wouldn't pull near as much power from the mains just because they were storing some of that energy up before they actually put it into that motor. You see what I mean?
I mean, I've seen devices floating around the place in the last couple of years where they effectively smooth out your energy consumption.
Well,
I don't know if you know anything about them.
Yes, well, there's all kinds of different ways to basically, like a regular transformer, your average Joe transformer. You go fill, Muddy calls them wall warts. You use them to plug into your cell phone or whatever, charge your cell phone up. You go touch them things and you'll feel that they're producing heat. They're getting hot because they got a resistance in there. And it's not necessary for it to get hot like that, you know. It's sitting there being used continuously, even when you're not charging your phone, it's still using electricity because it's pulsing that primary in that coil, you know, in that transformer. And so it's going to continue to generate heat as long as it's on. So if you had some way to put a little trigger switch on there, when your phone's charger gets when your phone's charged up, your phone sends a signal down to the transformer itself to shut the transformer off. When your phone voltage drops down, then it'll turn it back on. You see what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that they've talked about quite a lot over the, you know, kind of impending oil crisis that's supposed to be coming up was, standby devices. If you've got your TV on standby, your DVD player, your Blu-ray player, whatever, you might have, you know, a load of equipment in your house, you know, that's on standby mode, that's chewing up huge amounts of electricity because those transformers still need to be charged.
Yeah. They're still using juice even when they're not being used. And so that's what I'm saying. If you got a smart circuit inside there that will detect whenever it's not in use and shut the transformer off, you could save a massive amount of energy cost.
Yeah, they talk about all these smart devices, but how smart are they really?
Well, they're only as smart as the guy that created them.
I think people are creating much, much more efficient devices. It's just they're told not to. You know, stop. You need to knock that on the head, sunshine, because to be perfectly honest, our profits are going down because people are using less energy, and we want them to use more. You know, it's not a good business model to suddenly have a load of your customers using less when you charge by the unit.
Well, there in the computer, you got a battery inside your computer system that keeps the CMOS alive whenever you shut the computer off. Otherwise, you'd have to go in there every single time and reset all your settings. So that battery keeps, while it's off, keeps the memory so that you don't have to do that. And so with that said, the rest of it doesn't need to be on. You know, if you take that little switch down there on your surge protector and you shut that thing off, then none of the transformers inside that box are going to be energized. So you're not using juice when it's not being used, and it'll still hold its memory. You could do the same thing for TVs and VCRs and all that, you know. I had never understood why they didn't have little circuit boards in there in some of the TVs and VCRs, that if you unplug the doggone thing, like your microwave oven, you got to reset the clock if you unplug it. You know, why not have a little battery pack inside there? You know, easily accessible in case the battery went bad, you could replace it easy. But then if your power goes off, you don't have to go running around resetting all your clocks. But in the meantime, you're not sending energy to that transformer. You see what I mean?
I don't see why there wouldn't be an uninterrupted power supply in most devices. Because you think about it, if you're watching the TV or watching a movie or whatever, and the power goes out, how big of a battery with the current lithium technology do you need to get that to run for another hour?
Well, those doggone APCs, automatic power supply units that you got out there, they'll give you 15 minutes after the power goes off before it'll shut itself down. And how it shuts itself down is there's a circuit in there that detects, some of them are 24 volts and some of them are like 36 volts that run the transformer in there, the inverter portion of it. And so when it doesn't detect 36 volts any longer, it will shut that thing down. If there was a way to shut off that portion, it would run a lot longer than the 15 minutes, you know, but you drain your battery way down each time. But if you added some batteries to that bank, for every, you know, like if it takes two batteries to run it, if you're running like a 24 volt system, you add two more batteries in series with each other and then in parallel with the first pack, then you're going to double that time. You see what I mean? And calculating up your amp hours, you could actually build an inverter system that would, while your power's on, it'd keep those batteries charged up, and then when your power goes off, it's uninterrupted like you're talking about.
I did think it was interesting the other day when I was in an electrical store, and they were telling you what the power consumption, the average power consumption based on, you know, general user habits of, you know, maybe 2 or 3 hours TV a night, what you would expect to pay to run these devices over a 12-month period.
Well, I'll tell you one thing for sure. If you was to just shut things off, you'd be surprised at your bill. You know, unplugging them from the wall is what I'm talking about. Realize how many transformers are in the majority of your appliances out there, with the exception of your toaster. Your toaster is probably the most efficient one you got because it don't have a transformer. It doesn't rely on a transformer. It's a resistive load like a light bulb. And so,
hilarious thing is when I left my house in Ireland and came back here in September, I turned off the circuit breaker in the house, so there's no power in the house at all. There's nobody living there at the minute, and I'm still paying €30 a month in standing charges.
Yeah,
and standing charges basically there to cover the cost of infrastructure and all that sort of rubbish.
Even if you ain't using no power at all, they still get you.
Yeah, I mean, we probably won't be back there for another year. I have 12 months of zero power usage at all, and it would still cost me €360 a year, and government levies and VAT and all the rest of it. And I'm thinking, what's the point?
I'm saying we can become energy efficient. I know we can, at the very least, energy efficient. Now, I'm a firm believer in free energy because just like Tesla was trying to tell everybody, we're surrounded in a sea of energy. And so, you know, with that said, it's all about whether or not we want to take the time to do it ourselves to make the gizmos that need to be made in order to make this a reality. And that's why I want to put together a team of people to get together and do just that. You know, worst case scenario, we at least make an electric generator run more efficient, where you're not wasting so much fuel. Instead of only running for a couple hours per 5 gallons of fuel, then you can get it to run for at least half the day for the same amount of fuel. You know, the way that these things are designed, they guzzle fuel and the heat loss off of it. The same generator, you got to try to figure out how to keep that thing cool. You know, you got exhaust heat coming off that thing. You got engine block heat coming off of that thing on an air-cooled motor. And so what's to stop a person from taking that heat off of that engine and making the carburation system, making the engine from that carburation system work for you? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you could take the same exact generator, modify the carburetor on the thing to get it to send a fine mist of gas down inside there, adjust your air fuel mixture to the extent to where now it's running efficiently, and take the heat that is generated, waste heat that was generated off of that, to recycle that to heating water or even heating your house. Heat will transfer just like electricity. It's energy. You can, like, copper is a really good conductor of heat. That's why if you look at the best pans on there, they'll have a copper coat on the bottom of them, because it transfers the heat evenly across there.
Well, you look at the top end motherboards in PCs. I mean, I had an X58 chip back in 2009, and that had oodles of copper on it. All of them are heat sinks.
Yeah. And, you know, you can learn something from the mistakes of the people out there making the gizmos that we're buying, you know. Anyway, what do you say we take another music break, maybe slightly longer this time, and regroup and come back for the last hour of the Mad Science Show?
I certainly need to take a little trip to a special room in the house.
All right, well, everybody, stay tuned. You're listening to Mad Science. Hope we're benefiting you some. Peace and love, everybody. Take care. We'll be back.
Go blind. See through you. See through. Will someone try open up your eyes? You must be blind if you can't see the gaping hole called reality. Wanna do it again? I'm gonna do it again. Wanna do it again? Come on, I'm gonna do it again. Hear me out.
Better be the best tasting beer in the world. You got lucky.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Hello, everybody. We're back. Yeah, home fuel cell for power. Is that what you just said?
It's a hydrogen fuel cell designed to power your home.
Cool.
I just come across the website of an hour ago, actually.
Well, speaking of powering homes, I was thinking about that idea that I was talking about earlier about getting together and building a concept model of the perfect energy efficient home. I also was thinking about the whole deal, how the frying pan works. You know, you seen them copper-plated frying pans?
Oh, yeah, they're great to cook with.
Yeah, they equally distribute the heat from one side to the next. So I was
basically, what the copper does on the bottom is, because it's such a great heat conductor, it makes sure that, you know, the heat, as it comes through to the top layer of the pan itself, then because copper heats up so quickly but doesn't melt, I think it's about 1500 degrees Celsius is the melting point of copper, that means you've got a distributed heat, so every part of the pan is going to be the same temperature.
So what would be stopping an individual, say, let's say you had a concrete floor, but before you poured that concrete, you put a big huge flat plate of aluminum underneath there, you know, big sheet metal style, whatever, up underneath that, and then underneath that itself, you actually had a place where you could have one of them either a regular light bulb or a heat lamp light bulb, to where whenever that light was on, it would radiate that heat across that copper and then heat that that concrete floor up. You see what I'm saying?
Probably because concrete blocks a lot of heat.
Well,
it is an insulation material.
There's my friend that lives right around the bend from me. Before he put his house in, he ran tubing, basically plastic tubing, like that PEX tubing. He ran it back and forth across the entire floor and then laid his concrete right down over the top of that. And all he had to do from that point on was circulate hot water through that floor, and it kept the floor warm. So you could literally walk barefoot on a concrete floor in the middle of winter, and your feet wouldn't get cold.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah. So, you know, even if it was only just maybe an eighth of an inch underneath the concrete or something like that, you know, I would venture to say you wouldn't want it, like, directly underneath certain types of carpet, because it could get hot and melt the carpet. You know, but...
What I was thinking as well is in reinforced steel, reinforced concrete, you normally have a steel mesh.
Yeah.
So why not hook up that steel mesh in your floor to something that's going to harness static electricity, so you've got a constant charge going through it?
Oh, there's a possibility I didn't think of right there. Every old existing concrete floor already has that iron in there. You could transfer the heat through iron, whereas it probably wouldn't be as efficient as, you know, say copper as far as dispersing it equally. There's a big giant grid up underneath your concrete floor. That's what holds all the concrete together.
But so, if you're just using native static electricity to provide that charge, then it ain't going to cost you anything.
Yeah.
Although you might want to be careful about lightning strikes.
Yeah. Well, there's all kinds of possibilities there, but getting to the back to the whole building, the energy efficient house thing, you know, everything from whenever you have your roofing on there, you know, if you've ever been on top of a roof in the middle of summertime, and even in the wintertime, tops of roofs are warm, you know, unless they're covered with snow. They stay pretty warm because that material seems to absorb heat and holds it in pretty well. And inside your attic, you have to have those attic fans vents so that your attic don't get too hot. You know, because if you've ever been up inside of any attic, you notice that there's a lot of heat up in that attic. Now, what's to stop you from bringing that heat out of that attic down to the basement and then back up into the house again? And also using the same effect to run hoses back and forth across your roof, that when that heat is beating down, then you're going to heat water up as well, circulating water through that deal. You see what I mean?
It depends on exactly how much heat you've got. That's part of the problem.
Well, I'll tell you what, those attics will get hot enough that you don't want to be up there in the middle of summer, definitely, or wintertime even for that matter. They're still warm up in there.
Oh, no, my attic was pretty cold in Ireland, mate, believe me.
Well, how many drafts did you have in it?
Well, you've got to have ventilation or else you get condensation.
Yeah.
So there's quite a big trough going through it. I get what your point. I mean, I actually worked as a roof tiler's laborer when I was young, and getting up on top of one of them roofs in the middle of summer is, you gotta be careful because you get yourself burnt.
Yeah.
But
either way, yeah, you pull that heat off the doggone roof, and obviously you're not gonna want to heat your house during the summertime, but you could also use a heat exchange system to generate electricity, you know, taking the heat off the roof and using that heat differential with Peltier elements, stuff like that. You know, or thermocouples, thermopiles, whatever, to generate a thermoelectric deal. So everything that your house is doing, you get some sort of benefit from.
I mean, the concept of building a roof out of, tiling your roof with kind of thermoelectric tiles would make sense.
Yeah.
Because then you're basically taking the energy of the sun. It's like Tesla was saying, there's energy everywhere.
Well, that's the point.
Working out how to harness it.
All these bad things that we keep that we don't want, like if you live in the desert, you don't want heat.
You know? No, you don't.
It's too doggone hot. You want to stay cold. So using a little bit of basic science and some heat transfer, you know, that's how them doggone heat pump systems out there work, you know. They change the heat. If it's cold outside, you know, they'll transfer that heat, the temperature difference. So
that's blocked. I'm in an equatorial part of Asia. You know, we're literally 60-70 miles from the equator. And it was really cold the other day, and everybody was complaining how cold it was because it was 27 degrees Celsius. Usually it ranges between 30 to 34.
Well,
I'm sitting in here with a pair of Bermuda shorts and a t-shirt. Everybody else in England is running around like an Eskimo, all wrapped up to the eyeballs.
In your area, a heat exchanger would, you know, be what you'd be needing to take that heat and turn it into cool, you know, evaporated cooling, that kind of deal right there. You know, it's a lot of heat generated, so when you heat water, it turns into steam, and steam evaporates. So when that water is condensing and falling back down, you get cool. You see what I mean?
Well, I mean, if you don't have your aircon on you when you're sitting indoors, you sweat.
Yeah.
It's kind of, if you're indoors, you have your aircon on. Which is crazy, because I've gone into people's houses, and they've got their aircon set at 20 degrees, and the outside temperature is 14 degrees higher.
Huh.
And I said, well, why don't you put it at about 25 or 26? You use a hell of a lot less energy. And you're kind of acclimatizing yourself anyway. So when you do go out, you don't feel the heat as much.
Yeah, instead of bringing it down to where you got snot sickles on your face from being frozen to death inside your house, I mean, why live inside a freezer when you can just set it down to where you want it to be just comfortable, you know? Just cool enough where you're not sweating.
But most human beings are capable of adapting to different climates. You know, that's part of how our bodies work anyway. It's like when you go up into high altitude, your body will produce more red blood cells to make sure the oxygen carries around your system a lot better, because there's less of it.
Well, then, you know, whatever environment you're living in, you build your house accordingly. And you build it, you know, with a backup system in case the environment changes. You know what I mean?
It is. Is that why all the people that live in Tornado Alley build their houses out of wood?
Well, I'd be guessing it's because the insurance company's got a good racket going on. As long as you're afraid your house is going to blow over and trash everything you got, then they can extort money out of you in the form of payment every month. Or what do they call that? What is the word, the technical term for the payment for the... your premium.
Gouging.
Yeah, gouging. So, if they know there's a chance that your house will blow over, they'll say, hey, yeah, we'll give you money if your house blows over. You just pay us all the time when your house don't blow over. And so you got thousands of people paying money in case their house blows over, and that nobody's house ever gets blown over, they make out like a bandit. Heck, that's better than odds at any casino, you know. You want to gamble, you go in the insurance business. You sell people, you know, that, hey, you, something happens to you, I'll give you some money to fix it, you know. And if nothing ever happens to them, then they got a lot of free money.
Well, I found it interesting. I was looking at my mortgage, and I have to pay an insurance that if the house gets burnt down or destroyed or whatever, then there'll be a fund there to rebuild it with.
Yeah.
But I said, so if I pay off that mortgage over 25 years and I never need to have my house rebuilt, who gets the money?
It ain't you.
And I said, what do you mean who gets the money? I said, well, I basically paid you for a service which isn't necessary. So are you going to refund me the... I think it would probably work out at something like 30 or 40,000 euro over the lifetime of the mortgage. Where does that 30 or 40,000 euro go? Considering no service has been required.
Well, it's like the life insurance scams out there. One of which is that, you know, if you pay into this life insurance policy for a certain period of time, you can actually take a loan out against your life insurance policy. Of course, you know, with loans comes interest and fees and such. So instead of them having to pay the full price of the life insurance if something happened to you, they would deduct whatever you took the loan out of the deal, plus their fees and all that. So they're making out like a bandit. They're not having to pay near as much as they would have if you just left it alone and paid your deal, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, put the money away somewhere where it's actually going to be some use to you, and you don't have to jump through hoops to get it.
Yeah, why couldn't you be your own insurance company?
Well, see, I was talking to them, and the only way that that fund can ever be transferred from them is to another insurance company. So why don't they start me on?
Yeah, that way it transfers straight to you.
Yeah, at the end of the period, one year before the end of the mortgage, I start my own insurance company, get it paid over to me, and then I get it.
Yeah.
But there's this concept that you cannot self-insure. You need to go for a third party to do it.
Well, there's where all the scams are. There's scams in energy, there's scams in food and medicine, and it's just, you know, when's the average Joe going to get so fed up of being scammed that they started working out their own systems that are self-reliant, you know? You put your money in your bank, and your bank takes money every so often because you got your money in their bank.
Well, technically it's not really a scam, because what they say is, well, look, if you have to rebuild your house, it's probably going to cost somewhere close to $50,000 for the material and labour. Although we sold it to you for three times that amount. The actual materials required and the labour to put it all together into the shape of the house will cost probably $50,000, maybe $60,000. So what we're doing is we're collecting little amounts from a lot of people, and fingers crossed, you know, they all get burned out.
Yeah, if they all get burned down, then who gets paid? Everybody gets a dollar.
The thing is, it's a bad call. Just that, hopefully Kevin won't drive a truck in the houses at the centre.
That's pretty much it, you know. The whole doggone system, it basically... If you you pay them all this money and nothing ever happens, then they make out like a bandit. If something happens, then they pay one person, whoever's had the problem, and then they keep on collecting from the rest of them. And then they'll jack everybody else's premiums up whenever your house goes up.
Yeah.
To compensate for what they had to pay out. So they're not losing.
What made me laugh is in September 2001, there was that awful attack in... Well, sorry, that didn't make me laugh. What happened after that was kind of amusing, because my motorcycle insurance over 5,000 miles away in Ireland went up after the September 11 attacks. And I said, well, you know, I've never seen any planes flying at low altitude in Dublin.
Yeah, so how is that going to affect your doggone motorcycle?
Well, yeah, I said I don't see any guys with turbans trying to crash into me in any sort of vehicle. So why are you putting my insurance premium up? And the reason why is because they're all part of a global fund. There's a very small number of people underwriting all of this stuff all over the place, and they're getting paid billions a year. And for some reason... it was a good excuse to jack up all the prices all over the globe.
That's just crazy, man. So there you go, man. That's the whole common sense factor of what we're talking about. Now, if you start from finish to build your house, to build it energy efficient from the get-go, using everything you know about basic science, heat rises and cold air falls, you put your cold air vents on the roof and you put your doggone heating on the floor so that you get the best out of what you got going through there. And then if there's anything out there that does waste energy, such as transformers or whatever, you might as well take advantage of that waste energy and put something near it that will, you could charge your cell phone. Instead of plugging your cell phone into the wall, just have that sitting next to your electric fan and having your fan charge your cell phone while you're running it. Because you can take one of them wireless AC testers and put it next to your fan motor, and you'll see that there's a field coming off of that. You can use that field to generate energy to charge your phone up. So why plug it into the wall for another 120 volts or whatever it is over your guys' area? Build a system right to your fan. You've got a USB charger set right on the side of your fan. All you got to do is plug your phone into it. Charge it up while you're running the fan anyway. See what I mean?
Wireless charging systems for mobile phones, like I think they're induction plates or something like that. where you just literally put your phone on the metal plate and it'll charge you.
Yeah.
They've been around for quite a while now. I mean, this is not a breaking technology anymore.
No. And so with that said, it might be an opportunity just to set your doggone phone itself on the fan motor itself. Because the phone probably already got the circuitry ready for it.
What I'm kind of considering is, what kind of impact does that energy field have on the human body? Because if you can put a plate, you put your mobile phone, just place it on a plate and charge it from that, why not the whole ground floor of your house?
Yeah.
Have one of those plates in it. And then you have no cables.
There you go. Everything in your house be wireless.
Yeah, I mean,
and all you need is an antenna from whatever, so you could put a single strand of wire from your light down to the deal so that it's within that field range and it would light the doggone light bulb.
That's my point.
So, number one, you'd be using a whole lot less copper, because you wouldn't have to wire your house the same way that you would be initially.
But then would you need to change the cycles of hertz? And maybe possibly change the actual amount of watts required to run it as well?
Well, it opens up Pandora's box of all different directions that you could go, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, if you're like your house wiring, your common house wiring already in your house is already circling you. So there's already a field in there. And so if you run the right frequency through there, even without being connected to the mains, you'll still be able to get wireless energy transfer out of those doggone wires.
The electrician made me laugh. I wanted to run a 10mm copper cable from the house out to the garden shed.
Yeah.
So I could use proper power tools. And he didn't want to work with that because it was too difficult to bend.
Really?
And I said to him, so you want to charge me €75 for every plug socket you put in, which is basically screwing a plastic box to the wall and connecting three wires to it, and you want to charge me €75 for every one of them, but you can't be bothered
to
put a proper cable out to it. Because he wanted to use 6mm, and I said, well look, that isn't going to carry the sort of current that I need.
Then for the average Joe out there, learn about the common, the neutral, and the ground, and wire it yourself. Just always remember to shut the power off before you go to connect the other ones.
Now the claim is if I was to do that and I wasn't a qualified electrician, it would invalidate my insurance.
Well, and there you go. There's another scam in the whole process. Even if you know how to do it, you can't do it, because if you do it, then you ain't got a license and you ain't got the sheepskin, so to speak. Then you know, you're just... You're doing it wrong, even if it's done right.
Well, that's kind of part of the problem with the world the way it is people won't take responsibility for themselves.
Well, heck, you can get out there on YouTube and you can find out how to do just about anything. I mean, there's a how-to for everything. And so, step-by-step how-to, you know, how to put a light socket in.
The how-to I'm interested in is giving back all the tax contributions I made throughout my life, because it's a wasted effort.
Yeah,
give me back all that tax money, everyone.
My tax dollars put that chuck hole in the road that your tire blew out on.
Yeah. Well, that is Congressman Bongwater for you. He does like he does like dragging that plow down the middle of the road after him.
Hey, he's going to sell more tires. I bet he's got stock in the tire companies, no?
Well, no, what he's saying is, vote for me and I'll stop dragging this plow down the middle of the road. your tax dollars won't be used to trying to fix it.
Yeah. So, that's it. That's pretty much it, man. That's exactly how they work the system. Now, we can build a house. I want to build a concept house, little cabin, start to finish. Totally 100% energy efficient instead of being energy inefficient, you know, electric motors and everything. I mean, why use 120 volts AC when you can get a 12 volt fan motor to do the same job? So you bring this thing down to where you get all your needs met, you're using the least amount of energy possible, and you're generating that energy that you're using from the means that are already available out there, such as solar and wind and thermal or whatever, you know, and radiant energy. And using Tesla's radiant energy patent, if you look real close to it, it's pretty much exactly how I explained it, you know, and there's a mathematical equation out there that will tell you how many yards or meters you get above the ground every so many, the voltage keeps rising until you're way up hundreds of feet up in the air. There's thousands of volts that you have access to just floating around out there. The atmospheric group out there, they got a couple 200-foot poles with a copper wire stretched across there, nano-coated with carbon, and so they're picking up thousands of volts of electricity, pumping it down in through huge capacitor banks and ending up with a lot of voltage on the other end of usable current. So,
well,
there it is, man.
I'd like to see a time when they get over this whole racially motivated attack against hemp. Because a hemp house has four key things to it. The walls are breathable, concrete isn't. That means it'll filter out a lot of the rubbish. It's flame resistant, it's pest resistant, and mildew resistant. It's like you said earlier, you put enough energy into anything and it'll burn.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm looking here at a site, Bringing It Home, Industrial Hemp, Healthy Houses and a Greener Future from America. And they kind of got spinning the angle of the carbon mumbo jumbo global warming, let's take all your money again, we still won't have enough to fix it. But, you know, this whole it's easy being green, well, it's easy being a mindless monkey and jumping onto the crack of a whip of somebody who doesn't represent you or anybody else. But hempcrete is basically industrial hemp mixed with lime.
And
it's as simple as that.
And it's not like it's scarce. I mean, you can find limestone everywhere. You can find doggone hemp everywhere. So, you know, it grows like weeds, pardon the pun.
Well, it's a huge insulative material as well.
Yeah.
You know, you can build various different types of structure with it. It's kind of, it's about 1/6 of the weight of concrete.
Well, concrete blocks are porous, and so they won't retain heat very well, you know. And so if you pack the inside of that center block there, the concrete block, with some sort of insulation, you'd still get it a lot better than it was. It's still going to have gaps in it and not retain heat, but hempcrete itself, there you go, man. And even in the mortar, you know, hempcrete mortar to put the bricks together, you'll make a really good insulator. And if you're getting it from the weeds anyway, then there you go, that's cheap.
I'm looking at a little article here of the house that hemp built. I'm going to stick a link in the chat for people to go and look at that, because that is kind of, that's like, you know, 70s house of the future stuff. And it looks really cool, in fairness.
Well, heat and lighting is the worst killer of your electric bill. You know, and so if you got a house that is energy efficient, that basically works like a thermos, it'll hold in the heat, it'll hold in the cool, then you will have a better house, but you don't have to have as much energy to run. And you were mentioning earlier about folks that are putting the doggone houses made out of sticks in Tornado Alley, when we had the capability of building dome structures that the wind will just go right around. I mean, if you go out and look at the buildings that are tore up during the tornado, you'll find there's buildings out there that they call Kwanzaa huts that are half dome shaped, you know, deals.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the term.
Yeah, well, those doggone things right there are normally standing whenever the tornado goes by. That's because the wind, it just goes right around them. Unless it hits the actual face of it, the flat side of it, then it don't blow over. If it hits the side of it where it's got the curvature to it, it will hold up to the high winds. And so if you took, instead of leaving a flat face on it, you domed out both ends of the Kwanzaa hut, then that house there would stand. You know, tornado hit direct hit from a tornado, it would still be standing because it's structurally sound.
Why don't you have a dirty great big turbine in the middle of the building? So if it gets by, it gets hit by a tornado, you can shoot yourself off up into space.
Yeah.
Get out of Dodge.
You know, if you live in a flood zone and your house floats, then you never have to worry about your house sinking.
Yeah.
You know, but there's especially beachfront properties out there. I never understood this. You know, there's always the potential of a hurricane coming in and massive flooding. But they'll still build these houses out of sticks and straw or whatever. And instead of making this house to be where it will withstand the wind, and if necessary, will float, you know, how high is the water actually going to get, you know? And so if you know from past history that the water might come 20 feet above the shoreline, if you have a tsunami or something, make your doggone house float, you know? Anchor it down. Put an anchored chain on there that allow you, or, you know, cable. They can make some really thin, long cables that are super strong that your house wouldn't float away. Whenever the storm's over, you just float back down and zip it right back into spot.
Well, they've already done that in Holland, Shaziz. In areas of low-lying water, they've been building experimental houses for the last 20 years that have stilts next to them. So as the water level rises, so do the houses.
Yeah, they do that down off of the river, down by the Illinois and Missouri line down there. They got houses that have been down by the river for years, and they got stilt systems. Even the garage is on a float. So if then the power line has a lot of extra slack in it, so they figured out the highest flood stage level that they've seen so far, and they got plenty of slack so that whenever the thing floods, the house just rises, the garage with the car in it rises, and it just turns itself into a barge and just sits there and floats in between these tall poles. And then whenever the water recedes, it all goes right back down to the ground again.
Well, guys, if you want to know what global warming is about, then go and have a look at carbontax.org. I mean, the tagline there is Carbon Tax Center. Pricing carbon efficiently and equitably.
Huh.
Now, according to NASA, carbon is the basic building block of all life in our known universe.
Yep. So they're going to tax everything.
We are made of carbon.
Yep.
The planet is made of carbon. Carbon is a basic structure of pretty much everything. So they're taxing everything.
That's pretty good whenever you can figure out a way to tax everything under the sun, including the sun and the wind and the water.
All these walking middle-class idiots that are running around university saying we have to save the planet, well, tell Daddy to get rid of his SUV then.
Yeah, or a corporate jet.
Oh, God, yeah.
If you're worried about busting a hole in the ozone layer, why are you sending rockets through it? You know?
People are not stupid. CO2 is not anything more than plant food.
Yep. But, you know, we still got to argue with them because they're the ones that somehow or another managed to get up there in the elected position of power, and they're telling us that we all got to reduce our carbon footprint. Well, in the meantime, across the town, on the other side of town, Snively Whiplash is dropping a bomb on somebody else and not mopping them back into the Stone Age.
Gore and blood is another thing that you might want to consider, because Al Gore and his with a certain blood are the ones part in the carbon exchange. That's a bit of an inconvenient truth, isn't it?
Yeah.
We've got to save polar bears. Oh, by the way, you're going to pay me to do it. Yeah, right, Al.
Huh.
What sort of idiot do you think I am? But on one hand, you're telling us that carbon, you know, all of these emissions are destroying the planet. But at the same time, setting up a carbon exchange to make yourself up to millions. Because we have to come and buy all of our stuff from you.
Yeah, monopolizing nature.
Even here, August 4th, 2015, Obama climate plan revives talk of a carbon tax. Now they're talking about people that don't pay the taxes can be refused or have their passport revoked for travel.
Well, when it comes down to get the bill for the carbon tax, I'm not paying it, and I'll get my day in court with the judge, and I'll educate the judge on what carbon is all about. Until then, I ain't paying it, period.
Well, the science is so itchy, didn't you hear?
Oh, of course Ed. Yeah, the debate's over, man. Really? I mean, you take a poll from science guys, and the science guys want to get money from the government, so they want to agree with the government so they can get their money. If they don't agree with the government, they don't get their money, and they're called quacks. So I think the numbers are skewed.
Well, not only that, they've openly admitted that HARP weather modifications experiments were successful.
Yeah.
So when they say about, you know, man-made climate change, yes, it probably is, and I wish that man would stop.
Yeah, no kidding. And that whole chemtrail episode out there, they're not spraying nothing in the sky. Okay, that's what they tell you. But you see it, but they're not doing it. But even if they ain't doing it, if those trails are really leaving that kind of exhaust, they're pretty much out of tune as far as I'm concerned. They're still spraying carbon in the air. You know, regardless, it's fossil fuel they're burning in those jets. Yeah, regardless, it's still coming down.
I rang the EPA in Europe to find out what was going on. I was in about 2012, I think. And I rang up the EPA, and the only person that would talk to me was a new hire guy. I think they just put him on to me because nobody else wanted to actually have a serious conversation about what was in the sky. Huh. And I said, have you seen all of those vapor trails that seem to crisscross the sky in a tic-tac-toe pattern? You know, that game of noughts and crosses. That seems to spread out and leave a blanket of smog over the entire area. And he said, I haven't seen them. I said, what, do you live in a cave? Have you some sort of version of early onset osteoporosis that bends your neck forward so you can't look up? I mean, are you blind?
It must be.
And he said, well, we've no evidence of it. I said, have you done any tests? Because they send up hundreds of weather balloons every year in most countries around the world. And I said, so you're telling me that these weather balloons that you send up to collect particles in the atmosphere and then test them to see what the air quality is like, you haven't actually sent it up anywhere where these particles are so you can see what's in it.
Well, somehow
he said we don't do tests on that nature. I said, well, that's probably why you got no evidence of it then.
Yeah. And as far as that goes, they can tell you how many parts per million of carbon's in the air, but if they ain't got the information, how'd they get that information if they didn't have the evidence?
I mean, I said, on one hand, you're telling me that I need government permission to put a 1,000 litre tub of water in my back garden and chuck a few fish in it to protect the environment. But when there's obviously something being sprayed into the atmosphere that wasn't there 20, 30 years ago, that isn't really worth your concern. But me being able to feed my family is something that I need permission from you to do, even though you're not a government agency. You're a quango. You're a quasi-autonomous non-governmental organization. Therefore, you have no authority over a sovereign.
Yep. Well, their whole complaint is carbon emissions, yet there's still plenty of commercial flights being going overhead. There's still plenty of military jets going overhead, but yet it's a ground-based carbon that they're worried about. You're driving your car, and so you're polluting the planet. You got to shut your car off. Well, they're still flying the jets, and they're not going to stop flying the jets. You think people are going to not want to fly from one country to the next or state or whatever? They're going to continue to fly, and it's still going to be carbon in the air. So if you got all these flights going on all day long that are leaving trails in the sky, then that ought to be a red flag that if you're trying to cut down the so-called carbon emissions in the parts per million range that's supposedly causing the global warming, then maybe you ought to ground the airplanes too. You see what I mean?
Well, they kind of jacked up all the prices on air travel. And a lot of it was for this invasive security checks that they do. And you have to pay them to rub your love junk. Seriously. That's what all those airport fees are for. So you can have some retarded lunatic to stand there, threaten and intimidate you because of what?
Yeah, because somebody might be a terrorist. You know, but the problem is, in order to not offend the terrorists, they let certain people go right on by. Oh, you're all right. Yeah, see you later. that's a nice AK you got there, by the way.
Well, it's not offending the terrorists that I'm concerned about. It's funding the terrorists that seems to be the problem.
Yep. Well, either way, it all shows, in the realm of mad science, it all shows the ludicrousy of the system out there, and everybody's trying to find the holy grail of free energy, when it's all along, Tesla and guys like him throughout history have shown it over and over and over again. And we got nuclear power plants right now that they put on fault lines for some crazy reason, that when they go awry, they end up creating a radioactive hazard, so to speak, all over the planet, you know, such as Fukushima. And if everything was so dramatically terrible about Fukushima, don't you think the world's governments would be all over it? Don't you think that it would be mainstream news that there's people dying of cancer and dropping like flies everywhere. We got to get this under control. But yet they're not. They're not making a big scene about it. And, you know, okay, maybe they don't want to panic the public. You know, we got this massive radiation leak going on over there. Well, if it's a problem such as global warming, which doesn't seem as much a problem as direct radioactive water pouring into the ocean, then I'd say that would be the priority list. That's the one you want to address first, because you're killing off the doggone Pacific Ocean. So if you're killing off the Pacific Ocean and the food chain's going to drop after that, then you might want to address that first and get that taken care of, because, you know, we got so many days till climate chaos, according to the carbon deal, yet you're still flying jets and dropping bombs?
Well, Chaziz, doesn't that remind you of something else that they used to have back in the Cold War? It's called the, it's the, what was it, 4 minutes to midnight.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how far you wait for, or 10 minutes to midnight, or 6 minutes to midnight. And scientists would adjust the clock based on social and political pressures.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that just rehashing the same old gibberish? And then we find out after the Cold War, the Russians and Americans were working with each other all along.
Yep, kind of like what Obama told, when they had a hot mic going on, Obama told old Putin over there, he said, well, I'll be more flexible after the election. Have more flexibility.
I think that was Medvedev. That was before Putin, that was him with Medvedev, the previous...
whichever, he still told one of the Russian guys that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's nonsense. I mean, the whole EU thing, they talk about democracy. Well, I've never voted for the President of Europe, and neither have the other 500 million people that live there. Just 27 heads of state decide who's going to run the show.
Yeah.
It's like being back in the Cold War with Russia. It's like the Politburo.
It's all-star wrestling, man. It's all-star wrestling on crack. It's essentially, you know, when they're out there on you know, on the doggone mat, they're hating each other and beating each other up, and then whenever the show's over, they go down to the bar and have a drink together and, you know, yuck it up, best friends, that kind of stuff. That's all you're getting. You're getting a football game, all-star wrestling, dancing with the stars, and that's your representation out there in this world. And the people out there are making so much money off of you. Heck, all they got to do is call you up every once in a while via YouTube or one of the social medias out there and tell you some Y2K disaster's coming along, and you'll run out and buy all the generators and stock up on food and all that kind of stuff, when essentially that generator's probably going to sit on the shelf for the next 10, 15 years before you ever get around to using it. And then the next doomsday will come along and you'll go out and update because, yeah, that one's sitting around for a while. Might as well go ahead and sell that one off and buy a new one. You know, so they're going to sell you everything they can with all the fear that they can give you. They're going to charge you every bit of carbon tax that they can get out of you. They're going to charge you for the sun. They're going to charge you for the wind. They're going to charge you for the rain. They're going to charge you for everything, even your breath. So
the way it works, Shiz, is if we were lucky enough to come up with a system of energy generation where you could power your entire house, supply as much water as you needed, and you needed no connections to any third parties whatsoever, they would still come along and find some way to tax you, because you have to be in some sort of form of debt slavery for the modern world to operate effectively.
Yeah, and there's a phrase over here called zoning, where if you're in certain cities, there's zoning laws, and they will put on regulations, well, you can't build this without a permit, so you got to go get a permit if you want a shed, you got to go build it. If you find a unzoned property, then you buy that unzoned property, because as long as you can keep zoning away from it, you don't have the government interference with the deal. But the way they got it set up now, you want to throw solar panels out in your yard, there might be a regulation that says you can't put those solar panels out in your yard because they're an eyesore. They take away from the community's good looks or whatever. So you got to be careful where you're at. You know, not everybody can throw solar panels or wind turbines up, because then you got, you know, the whole, look, it's an eyesore.
It's not aesthetically pleasing to the old lady that twitches the curtains living across the road from you every time you have a visitor.
Yeah. In some places like California, they got doggone cell phone towers disguised as palm trees. Now, if it works for the government or them, they can disguise it as a palm tree. Then why couldn't it work for you in your yard? You know? But you'll find the standards are different when it comes to what you want to do as opposed to what they want to do. There's a different set of rules. So the way to get around that is start figuring out ways to generate your electricity. And don't ask for permission. Just do it. You know, go out there and study up on all these different how-tos and see how everybody else out there is working on these alternative energy devices. And take things that already exist and modify them a bit, and you know, move that energy away from it, and make yourself an efficient generator. It's that simple.
Yeah. Well, I think that we've oodles of technology floating around us. Most people, including myself, don't really know how to put all this together in some comprehensive form.
Well, that's why I'm trying to make my YouTube channel as simple as possible so that the average Joe can get some ideas and run with it, you know? And, you know, well, if I come up with something that I can take my house completely off the grid, I'm giving it to everybody. It's as simple as that, you know? According to the Keshi Foundation, it's already solved. You buy this little gizmo from them for 900 euros, and they'll send two out to the poor. That's part of the price, so they're selling three of them. And you plug it into your house, and then essentially it'll turn all of your wiring in your house black after a certain amount of time, and your entire house at some point is supposed to be able to be super inefficient, a superconductor, and you're going to get free energy. You know, you're going to save at least 40% on your bill. If anything at all, his energy device isn't nothing more than an efficient battery, and you're using the battery power as opposed to the majority of the power off the housing. So if you can imagine plugging in an APC, an automatic power supply like for your computer, and you're running off the batteries instead of actually running off the house, you only need the energy from the house to charge those batteries. As long as you're not draining a heavy load off of that, then the battery won't go dead. So if he's taking a nano coat and copper and basically using what he calls GANs as the electrolyte, essentially what he made was a really impressive battery. So he's not selling you free energy, he's selling you a battery pack. They call it a doggone transformer or something like that. I can't remember what the exact word he was, but he used. But if you study up the work that they're doing and you pay attention, what he's got going on is basically what Robert Murray Smith has been doing for years as far as nanocarbon and different materials to make really impressive capacitors. So you plug it into the wall. The power from your wall charges the battery up. You run your load off of the battery, and you save energy by doing it that way because it's not a direct load to the battery itself. It only costs you the energy that it costs to charge that battery. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
And if his...
That's kind of what we were talking about earlier anyway.
Yeah. If his device is basically nano coating your copper wire, turning it black, essentially, eventually it's going to come to the point where it could potentially be a house fire in the works. And if what he's saying is true, after a while you should be able to unplug that and not even have it plugged into the mains, and your house will be so energy efficient because it's all superconductor now that you will be able to not have to pay an electric bill. You see what I'm saying?
Well, one thing I would like to point out is this whole thing that's going on in Paris at the minute, those savage attacks last week, is Wizard of Oz stuff. Because while everybody's looking at Paris, they're not looking at things like the G20 summit, where they're openly admitting they're bringing in global governance. Now that's something that people really should be paying attention to.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, that's literally, don't look behind the curtain, look at the big face up there. Look at Oz, the all-powerful.
Yeah. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Some shady little guy in a shabby suit standing behind.
So we got Thomas in here, I think. Did he show up? Thomas, you
here?
Hold on. I think he done held it. Yeah. Got some sort of disconnection going on. Huh. Where'd he go? Dad blast it. Are you there?
No, one second, mate. There we go.
Are you back? Hey, you made it down for the last 8 minutes of the show.
Yeah, you're lucky that I even got in for that, man. I was moving all night last night until, like, I don't know, 6 o'clock in the morning, so...
Oh, that stinks. I was explaining to Steve how I think that Keshi's, energy device thing is working. Essentially, he's doing what Robert Murray Smith's been doing for years. Essentially, he made a battery. You know, he's got nano-coated copper wires, and they got the stuff that they call GANs, which is supposed to be what helps generate the plasma. And essentially, you mix the two together, and what you end up with is a battery. So, if you're running off the mains, you plug it into your wall, you got this nifty blue box that they sell, 900 euros, what the price was, I believe they said. And that means two of the units that you just bought, because you actually donate two units to two poor people out there, will get shipped out to somebody else. So it's got one heck of a deal going. You're forced to buy three to get one. Anyway, you plug it into the wall, it charges the battery up, and then you run your load off the battery. So essentially, all you have to pay for is the energy from the wall to the battery. That's it. So what he's got going on isn't by any means free energy. It's basically, it uses the energy more efficiently. As long as you're not running a resistive load, and that's why he keeps on saying about not running a resistive load on it until your entire house is nano-coated or whatever, basically turning all your wiring in your house black, what's going on there is you could run all the, you know, little small appliances you want off of it because you're running it off of the battery. As long as the battery stays charged up, you're not draining anymore. So he's talking about you'll save 40% on your energy usage. When in reality, instead of buying his gizmo right there, you could set the same exact system up with a charger and a battery bank. Like, you've got one battery charger, a 6-amp battery charger charging up a bank of 100 batteries in parallel. Whatever the amp hours on the batteries, you'll get that use out of, as long as you're running small non-resistive loads. But whenever you kick on like a light bulb, a tungsten element light bulb, it's obviously going to drain more power a lot quicker, so it won't last nearly as long, and you'll have to wait till it charges back up again. So he's got one heck of a scam going on, and a lot of people are falling for it, but they ain't doing nothing.
So you think basically this nanocoding he's talking about is probably the equivalent of a, I guess, a digital or a solid-state flywheel storing power away in over your wires, because now they're all coated with graphene. So they're going to basically hold a tremendous amount of electrons, and whenever you draw, you'll be drawing off of those first, thinking that you're, because your meter's spinning slower during that time, that you're generating power from his system, when actually you're just using power that his system used to drain it off of the
yeah,
grid.
Essentially a supercapacitor being charged up by the wall. That's it. That's it. So there's where he's
actually, that's if it's actually working.
Well,
we could take the flat earth approach and say, well, we haven't seen it ourselves, so it's working, so it doesn't work.
Well, he shows that he's running.
He's got a flying car. He's as good as NASA. Discount everything he says.
He shows that he's running a load off of them, but they're small appliance loads. And he talks about not running resistive loads off there, which would be the same thing that you'd be doing if you had a regular battery charger connected to a huge battery bank. You charge that battery bank up and you drain the energy off the battery instead of off the mains, and the battery charger is only going to draw the same amount that it takes to charge those batteries. That's it. And so you will get a 40% reduction, according to his deal, on how your that energy uses is. So he took some of what basically Robert Murray Smith's been doing for years, made an efficient battery, and
if it's graphene, then there's a good chance too, though, that all the energy is flying around you because of the radio waves and whatnot are supplementing it, so he can claim that as over unity.
Yeah.
It's like, well, it's taking power from the mains, but look, you get this extra, like, you know, for every $20 worth of electricity, you're getting this extra 50 cents worth of electricity. Where's that come from?
Yeah. Well, essentially, by his system, after a while, you said you got to have it connected to your house for like 3 weeks or more. It depends on what kind of, you know, what certain circumstances of your house or whatever. And then eventually, at some point, you'll be able to go to, like, the furthest portion of your house, peel back the wiring on one of your sockets, and notice that your wire is black, because it will nanocoat the entire wiring system of the house, in turn, basically turning your house into a superconductor, in which case then, if it's coated with this GANS material, will basically grab the plasma right out of the air, is what he's claiming.
You don't
want
to be in the high lightning zone, do you?
Yeah, well, if you look on a car battery, DC car battery, and you see that green that's running down the copper wire, that's called corrosion. And essentially, that's what he's doing, corroding your wires and turning them black. My question then is going to be this. How does that work on an aluminum wire system? Because there's a lot of electrical out there that they use aluminum instead of copper. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, they tried to do away with that due to the expansion and contraction that copper doesn't have.
Yeah, but they still got it.
Right. So, well, in aluminum, when it's been hit with any kind of serious voltage like that, if there's any oxygen able to get to it, it basically forms a very thin sapphire layer over it. It's just aluminum oxide that forms over the surface of it.
Yep.
To grow a thicker layer, you have to hit it with more voltage and potentially put a little acid in there with it to fluff up the aluminum out of the original source into the oxide layer to form an actual thick, like, sapphire layer. It's just aluminum oxide.
Well, they got this coating that they put at the connections now that's like this gray kind of goo grease or whatever that they do for that expansion contraction, because they were having problems with wire fires because of that. Anyway, that's pretty much it, man. We're down to the wire. Wish you'd have been here a little bit earlier, but maybe you could join us for the nights tomorrow. What do you think?
Well, I was going to say, if, I don't know about that. I'm still going to be moving. I'm not even close to done, so maybe next week.
All right, that's cool. There's always a place for you over here, brother, all the time. Anyway,
just,
folks.
Just getting sorted, so.
You've been listening to The Mad Science. I hope we said something beneficial there for you. If you know, got something you want to talk about, there's a chat room there. Jump on Skype. Join in on the conversations. And I'll see y'all for the Knights of the Round Table. Thanks, Steve and Thomas. It's always a pleasure as usual. So you guys have been listening to Mad Science. Peace and love. The podcast will be up ASAP, as soon as possible. Take care.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.